Okay. Our final discussion of today. Give the floor to Linda, right?
To start, yes. I'm great at delegation. Okay. So thanks very much. We're very much looking forward to the feedback from this group today. Hopefully you all received a folder, so you have a hard copy as well as some additional materials that we prepared for handout for this document. So, and I want to say that Rebecca's here to help me present today, and I'm very delighted to have Rebecca here. Some of you have missed her at the last meeting or two. In fact, Rebecca has moved on to a new role, and commensurate with that, this project has been a big part of her moving on to that old role, although I haven't let her take her total foot out of her old role because we haven't hired yet. But we're working on that. So Rebecca is now, I think the title is Director of Recruiting Initiatives and Research. Correct. First victory for today. So there you go. So and so one of her big contributions in the last few months has been working on this framework. So if you look at the second slide, pretty simple agenda. We want to give you some information up front about why we embarked on this activity, and then we want to get your feedback. So it's a fairly simple agenda. And one of the things that I always say when I start talking about the framework is that one of our key objectives has been to start a conversation. Well, one of the ways you start a conversation is you get people's attention, and I would say we've certainly gotten people's attention on both sides of this fence. Some love it, some hate it. I think we're in the right spot if we've gotten that much attention, so we're happy. So if you look at slide 3, this is one of the slides that we use to give people some perspective. It talks about the fact that there's a lot of information that is used to make investment decisions, and only a piece of it's in the financial statements. So this is an example where Fiat Chrysler was reporting their units sold. Okay, not their revenue number, but their units sold. And ultimately, they had a problem with that measure. And as a result, you can see what happened here. They made an announcement, said that, oops, we've gotten this measure wrong. And you can see what happened to their share price. And as well, that ultimately led to an SEC investigation. And then they had to do some reporting about some issues in terms of their inflated sales. And so the point of this slide is quite simple, is that users are using information. And they are using it sometimes with little awareness of the quality of the information that they are using. And so, hence, the board became persuaded that this was an important issue and we wanted to put some attention to it. And I'll come back to that again. The next one, I won't spend too much time on. It's another example. This one happens to be Twitter. Again, they overstated the number of users they had. In this particular case, the market didn't seem to care that they overstated the users because they actually beat their targets. So they didn't have the same consequences that Fiat Chrysler did. But the point was, is again, the market was looking at some non-financial information that was relevant to their decision-making, and it turns out that there was no quality over that non-financial information, or not enough to make sure that the measure reported was actually accurate. So I'm going to spend just a few more minutes on slide 5 to set the context, and then I'm going to turn it over to Rebecca. But we call this slide our journey because it sort of tells you how we got to where we got with regard to this project. Because initially, like most standard setters, I said, you know, these financial measures are outside the purview of the traditional standard setter. Why should we be doing this? Why should we be moving into this void? But I would say, in all honesty, the board, myself and the board, my fellow board members have moved our way through that. So if we go back to the fall of 2016, there was an article that appeared in our local paper, the Globe and Mail. It is kind of the business paper of Canada that talked about the rise of non-GAAP financial measures starting in 2004. I didn't bring it with me this time, but it went from 2004 to 2016, and the slope was a very steep slope that said, since 2004, now most companies, the number quoted in the article, I believe, was around 80%, that said 80% of all reporting issuers use some form of non-GAAP. And the rise over the years was quite significant. And so I was quoted in that article about the role of non-GAAP in standard setting. The securities regulator was quoted in the article because they have guidance around non-GAAP. But that started out with a discussion around non-GAAP. Moving forward, and there were some follow-up articles. Moving forward, we did discuss this topic with our own user advisory council. They had some views on it. But then there was a forum in the spring of 2017 that was actually a cooperative effort between our auditing board and the auditing oversight regulator, the CPAB, Canadian Public Accountability Board. It's like the Canadian version of the PCAOB. And that started out as, you know, a discussion around the relevance of the financial statements and the related audit. You know, is that still relevant? We had two panels, one with buy-side analysts, one with sell-side analysts, very senior analysts. The coverage that they had was equal to the market coverage, the full market coverage. So these were very senior analysts. And by the way, most of these analysts in both different sessions had their roots in auditing, so they were designated accountants as well as CFAs. So these were very senior analysts. And I was on the panel along with my counterpart from the auditing board and the head of CPAB, and it was moderated by a senior person from the CFA Society in the U.S. And so we talked to them about the relevance of the financial statements. And there were a couple of key things that I noticed in that discussion that were really pivotal to moving my thinking forward. First of all, the assertion was that the numbers varied, but in most cases people said, I use the audited financial statements for 10% of the information I glean, up to 20% of the information I use to actually make an investment decision. But in no case was that number more than 20%. They did agree that the financial statements were kind of like the foundational piece. So one analyst said, it's kind of like when you build a brand new house. You want to make sure your basement and your foundation is really strong, so you have the foundation. And then you put on the important stuff like, do I want 3 bathrooms or 4 bathrooms and 3 bedrooms and what kind of kitchen and all that good stuff. And all that, that's all the other stuff. But they did agree that the audited financial statements were kind of the foundational element, and they all said they had value, but that they only used it for this small amount of information. And when you actually probed with them, what you learned was that they understood the financial statements, including the notes, were audited. They understand somewhat less, with less clarity, what exactly it was the auditors did with the management discussion and analysis, as we call it, which in Canada, the auditing standard is the auditors have to read it to make sure it's not inconsistent with the financial statements, but it's not audited. So there was a lack of clarity on that. They knew the auditors did something, but they weren't sure. Again, these are very senior analysts. And then when I asked them about the rest of the information they use, and I basically said, so let's say it's 90% of the information, if that's the number, and you use that, what kind of quality controls and governance procedures does the entity have over that information? And I got everything from, oh, that's interesting, I didn't know I could ask that question, to a bunch of different variations that showed you that these very senior analysts went very quickly from the notion of audited financial statements to a review of the MD&A to the fact that they used all this other information and really weren't asking any questions about the quality of that information. And so when you think about that, that became kind of a lightning rod where I went back to the board. And, of course, there are the discussions that we have had here. Okay, so we've highlighted on this timeline where we've talked about things like wider corporate reporting that is not unrelated to what we're talking about, and also the Australian presentation with the academics that we had, I think, the last meeting. And in November of 2017, the board had a strategy session, which is cool, where I take them away for 2 days and make them talk to each other about what we're going to accomplish over the next year. And we had a long discussion as well as an external presentation on this topic from two very senior audit partners who had been doing work with board directors, audit committee chairs of very large companies. And it became very clear that there was a void here in terms of getting people's attention on this issue. And it's not for lack of trying. So our securities regulator has guidance around non-GAAP, but it is really focused on non-GAAP. as opposed to all the other measures that exist in this space. And non-GAAP is tiny compared to all the other things that are appearing that are being used by analysts. Our own association for the profession, CPA Canada, has put out multiple publications, but hasn't really been able to make much headway around getting quality behind this information. And so these two senior audit partners said to the board in this session, my board, saying, you know, you have the brand of the standard setter. You're an independent standard setter who is respected. And if you are willing to step into this and say, this is important, and you need to have quality in these numbers, people will actually listen to what you say. And so by the time we talked about this for a while, one of my board members said, well, if nobody else is going to step up, why not us? Because we are knowledgeable in this area. And it was that day in November when my board decided that we were going to do something, yet to be defined. Okay, yet to be defined. So fast forward, which in, by the way, in standard setting lingo, that was November of 2017. 2017, you're like the year before this year? Okay. So my point being that when you set your mind to something, you can actually focus. If you say, I'm going to do this, and we're going to focus on it, and this is important. So poor Rebecca stepped into this void and has been leading the charge. And we said, okay, we put a stake in the ground. We said we are going to have a first cut on this document by June, and that's the document that we're discussing today. So I just want to make the point about timeliness, that you can actually do something if you focus on it. So I think you've now said it three times, so I think you got it. So with that, I am going to turn it over to Rebecca to kind of finish off with the notion that we just want to, you know, take a few more minutes to set the stage, and then we can get your feedback. Rebecca?
Thank you, Linda. So following on from, I guess, the Globe and Mail article that had been done in 2016, when we were finalizing the framework, we were able to work with one of the reporters, David Milstead from the Globe and Mail, and he actually worked to actually put out an article that day to support us in the launch. And what we've included in the next few slides are really just some key points from the different perspectives to support the initiative going forward. One is the first from our Canadian Securities Administrators, so they are the provincial regulators, recognizing, of course, the importance of this topic. To Anthony Shilapati, who was actually a past board member, but he was the individual who had undertaken through his research firm Veritas to actually do the analysis that Linda referred to as that trajectory of angles of the growing use of non-GAAP measures, and his support for both the board and for the regulators for doing work on this. Importantly, just turning on slide 7, Richard Talbot is a very active CFA member, past board member within CFA in Canada. And, you know, when their perspective was, is great, but we need you to do more. And really what you can see from this quote is that this is a good first step, but they're actually wanting us to go further from a user's perspective. And they want us to bring not just to issue guidance, but do it collaboratively with preparers and other investment analysts at the table to hash out really what would be for each measure, what should be the guidance going forward, and to further push it forward is to say it's not just should be voluntary. We really want to see it mandated, and the suggestion here is to be picked up by securities regulators. So you can see what some of the expectations are being created, but importantly, as Linda finishes, we finish off on slide 8, this is really about, there's an area that we have concerns about quality, and our board is really wanting to get a conversation started as to how we can see improvements in reporting. On slide 9, just wanted to articulate, it is, from the board's perspective, the ask was we really want to raise awareness of the issues so that people will understand the depth of the challenges and then seek ways to see improvement in reporting. The board is not married to, should we say, finalizing this document. If we can get support from others to continue on the work, this is about, in the end, seeing better information so users are making those more informed decisions. Of course, we're also conscious of what the ISB's priorities are and through the Better Communication Initiative. So, of course, as we're undertaking this, we're getting feedback, and often our users will switch between what's in the statements to what is outside. So this is very much enabling us to get further input from them. And, of course, looking forward to the management practice statement that you're looking to revise, and great to have Matt here, but in essence, us being at this work can see supporting you in that way. Turning on slide 10, I do want to kind of put the marker down that from our board's perspective, and as Linda has shared about the users' views we've heard, is that financial statements are still very much a strong foundation, and that is the main focus of our board's work. But given the growing concerns, we needed to do something. And given the various parties that are issuing guidance, how can we bring this together in order to make the difference? And this is really where taking that advice that as an independent standard setter, what can we do to make a difference? It's leveraging our reputation, our ability to carry out consultations through our network in order to start that conversation. And the interesting trick here was leveraging off the conceptual basis, which we hadn't seen done in other guidance. We are attracting attention. Our framework is actually now one of the top downloaded PDFs from our website. The actual page, just within a matter of 2 weeks, that landing page has seen close to 1,800 views. So this is, in essence, within our world, that's, should we say, rock was used. It's rocking our website statistics with the interest that we're getting. So it's been really good. But this really comes down to how do we get everybody involved? And you can see from the different people that we've identified, and I have to say I've used this slide from other presentations, and the one that's missing for this group is standard setters, because we have a role to play. And it's importantly, and that's partly why we're here, to get your feedback as well broadly for the different jurisdictions you represent. But what can we do, and how do we get everybody talking? One of the groups in here that we don't often connect with, and what Linda touched on, and what actually we got feedback that really resonated, is this, is a group we don't connect with, but directors and those with oversight have a role to play in this, and they could help demand further work and to enhance the quality of this, given their responsibilities. So just really wanted to call them out as an important group we're wanting to have involved. But we really do think that by working together, we can actually make a difference in this space, even if it is voluntary guidance. Turning to slide 11, I just wanted to recap really what we've been hearing from our users when it comes to some of those key concerns with the performance measures that they're seeing. And performance measures have been called alternative performance measures, KPIs. We've tried to capture a broad term here. But importantly, when it comes to, there's really concern about the lack of transparency about measures used, as to why it's relevant, how is it being determined. From a consistency standpoint, they're seeing within one entity it change year to year, and they don't understand why. What they do see is often those adjustments are more favorable from an entity's perspective. Of course, then if you don't have consistency within an entity, it's really challenging then to have comparability between entities. And when you think of how different investors and other users analyze information, and if you're just going off certain information reported through terminals or other services, you're not getting that additional insight into those measures. The other interesting aspect we did hear from a public company perspective was that while information is disclosed about management compensation, there wasn't an explanation about how it impacted performance measures and then their compensation. The interest here is to understand the effect, not to try to change compensation, but from their perspective, this was key. So really needing to highlight the need for better disclosures there. And as well, there's an education component to this, and that really comes down to that expectation gap. One was when we started talking about the different types of performance measures, many users weren't aware of those different types, hadn't thought about them from that perspective. It followed on was they were, as Linda mentioned, senior analysts, that some of these users didn't appreciate that this information wasn't audited. On the other hand, they didn't appreciate for some entities the rigor that actually goes behind management's processes and procedures and some governance aspects. So clearly, trying to better express what actually happens and getting companies to explain that as well is quite important. So these were kind of what we identified are the issues of what we were wanting to do in starting this conversation and to what we wanted to address, and really felt that a framework was the way to go. And I want to emphasize that this is voluntary. So, of course, when it's not a standard, that gives you a little bit more flexibility. So you'll see we have you try to use more plain language. We have graphics to better engage what we see is going to be a broader stakeholder group and people that aren't all accountants. Turning to slide 12, what I do want to highlight from a scope perspective is that this is about not mandating why entities are going to be disclosing or requiring them to disclose performance measures. This is when an entity has decided to do it. Here's helpful guidance to consider. From an important aspect, this means it's not just performance measures that might be in a management commentary or MD&A. This often extends to a donor presentation, investor presentations, social media, and any other communications organizations are doing. So it's important to keep that from that perspective in mind. But as we undertook this, one of the first steps the board said is let's work from a public company perspective. But as we started to share the framework, we started to hear how useful this could be to a broad range of entities, even including public sector. So it was at that stage, actually in May, where the board said, let's expand this so we can broaden the conversation to include the entities that are really subject to under the board's mandate. So that very much is publicly accountable enterprises, private enterprises, not-for-profits, and pension plans. And why we wanted to highlight those on this slide. To talk about to the approach, so wanted to, you probably smiled when you started to read it because you would have recognized many different aspects within the framework, is we have really tried to leverage what others have been doing but articulate it within the context of performance measures. And by taking this different approach, we weren't setting out to do an exhaustive research of all potential aspects. We looked to experts to say, okay, here, what are the key drivers for you? And leverage that guidance as part of bringing it together within the framework. And it is really kind of through that approach that you could actually try to achieve this type of document. And from a staff perspective, it was 4.5 months that we undertook to actually develop this and translate it for publication. So quite a challenge for those who deal with translation as well. But as part of starting this conversation, I do want to set out that there are, in doing this, we've tried to have the framework appeal to that, should we say, the types of entities that the board is supporting. So when you look to the objectives, the qualitative characteristics, materiality, you'll see it has a lot of similarities to the ISB and in other frameworks. But we've really done it and made some tweaks to make it appeal to those different audiences. So from an IFRS preparer, we do think that the words are similar and is going to result in a similar thought process, so it's quite consistent. But for those techies in the room, I know you quickly spotted some changes that we made, in part, shall we say, for plain language. Faithful depiction seemed to resonate with some of our readers more. When you talk to them about free from error, that just seemed too high a bar and outside of the financial statement. So when we included the word material, there was more comfort there. The other aspect, and this may be a bit more from a Canadian perspective, is materiality concept applies not only to relevance but also to faithful depiction. So you'll see that that concept applies to both. And as well, in wanting to think of the range of entities who could actually be potentially apply the framework, it could be a large developed organization to a new startup. There needed to be some, should we say, flexibility that they can use their judgment and how they develop their policies through to the procedures that they have. We've brought in cost benefit to enable that type of use of judgment. As we are standard setters, just turning to slide 14, due process always is important, but this is not a standard, so we actually are able to do this outside of our due process handbook, or manual is what we call it. So what was important is we did apply those elements, of course, of transparency, consultation, and accountability. So you can see how we've tried to undertake this so people were aware of what we're doing, how we've leveraged the experts within our area, including meetings that Linda's had with some very senior directors as part of getting their perspectives, and of course getting input on multiple drafts. One of the key highlights we did have was we brought together through a forum people from three different locations in Canada, which involves 16 people, particularly five users, six preparers, and three directors to have a discussion. And until you actually have preparers and users together where they can share different views, they're actually, their position shift, and one of those and I will articulate a little later. So just valuable in bringing them together. From an accountability, we have been reporting to our Oversight Council these activities, and they've actually expressed quite a bit of support for the board in doing this. And from a, as well, from a number of how long you provide documents for comment, it will be out for 90 days. So you can see we are trying to follow some of those concepts of due process and principle. To become a little bit more, delve into more detail on slide 15, to talk about the types of measures and to educate what they are, we've leveraged off of guidance CPA Canada has done in different documents to have these descriptions and categories. So importantly, what we at the board is proposing is that this framework can be applied when you are doing a measure outside of financial statements that relate to non-GAAP financial measures, other financial measures, and operational measures. So very broad. From a public company perspective, one of the questions we get asked is how is this going to help me with my compliance with securities requirements? And we were pleased that within just in the process of finalizing the framework, we were able to get some initial reactions from our regulators, and the board considered that and did make some changes. Overall, there are some potential discussions that we want to have with them because our objective is that this framework would actually complement the work that they're doing. But we've got some dialogue to have with them to get there. And valuably, actually, these chief accountants of our Canadian regulators are going to be meeting with the board in next week to start that discussion. So just turning to slide 17, we've done a one-page kind of overview. What kind of jumps out at you, first of all, is that this is just beyond financial, should we say, accounting in the realm we work in normally. We've brought in management aspects. But what's quite important is when you think of when you're going to select and determine a measure, this is about establishing policies so that you have up front can think, identify how you're going to develop estimates and the types of judgments you'll make. So you'll have set out that rationale in advance. And if you think through some of the qualities that we're encouraging and neutrality, hopefully this will give people some thoughts as when they are wanting to make adjustments, the nature of those. But given how disclosures are, should we say, building, one of the focuses, of course, is doing a stand-back assessment. So when you're wanting to add another measure, we are encouraging people that they consider whether that incremental information is useful. In leveraging off, of course, the concepts, we're hoping that people will then pause and think as they're doing that work really as to how the quality can be enhanced. And, of course, also being practical through the use of materiality and the cost-benefit. But working through through the kind of the right side of this diagram, what we're wanting to do in focusing in on a governance and the role of internal controls, and you think of all of the inputs and this other systems that some of this data will be coming from, that you know data integrity is important. So part of this has been identifying the procedures management should be undertaking, but as well the governance, should we say, steps that directors and others could be doing, including the types of questions they could be asking of management. Of course, if you're enhancing the quality of how you're selecting the measure, how you're determining it and building it through, that's going to result in more effective communication because that information is more relevant. We also do touch on, should we say, some of the principles that people can think about when it actually comes to what information is disclosed. But importantly, rounding down to the bottom half, the intent here, as I've said, is all the different people within the financial reporting process, they each have a role to play. And hopefully by calling them out and engaging them in discussion, this will all help us to take some of those next steps. On slide 17, we just wanted to share a few of the concerns that we've been hearing so far. And it was at that forum where previously we had heard some preparers say, when you look at what this framework is trying to cover, not just from a financial but operational, how could the rigor be the same for an operational metric as it is for financial? Well, then the users in the room expressed, well, of course it has to be of the same level of rigor. It's so important, and depending on the type of analysis they do, some of those operational metrics drive their valuations, so it's quite important. So it was interesting when you bring those together, what results? As you don't have experience from your own discussions. But clearly, for some, they are wanting us, and a part of that, how far can we enhance comparability or achieve that? The ability to do industry guidance is some of the feedback we've been hearing. From an applicability, partly is how far do we need to go in distinguishing financial and operational measures. We've had some suggestions even trying to bring in, should we say, fair value hierarchy, like in IFRS 13, to distinguish the rigor or the level of disclosures that might be valuable between the different types. And, of course, for those that want to see comparability, or I would almost suggest sometimes uniformity, some users are encouraging, this is where they would really very much like to see that it be mandatory. On the flip side, others are expressing concern even with this framework as a proposal because they see it as potentially hindering management's ability to tell their story. So there's really, if you say, that range of views. But as we're used to that as standard setters, the question is where can we find that middle ground? From that regulatory perspective, and we'll touch on it a little later, just as we're wanting a little more insight with the experience in your jurisdictions from a regulatory perspective, is, of course, people would like that if you've applied this framework, then that would mean you've achieved, from a preparer's perspective, all your regulatory compliance. When regulations are changing, that can become challenging. But one important aspect to consider is often, at least in our regulations, they relate more to scope, what are fall within that, and we would say our framework is much broader than just non-GAAP measures, but as well the disclosures are, in essence, taking from a perspective of not to mislead. Where we are trying to actually take earlier steps in that process on how you select and actually determine that as part of building out the quality. From a verification perspective, we have had, there's a range of steps, so as you can see, the framework being encouraged from the steps management takes, but as well as potentially roles of internal auditors, but there are people asking for more. We have learned through this process that there are specified procedures done for certain types of measures that they provide for, often for regulatory requirements, but could more be done? And that's something our auditing colleagues are thinking about. The other aspect, and we've actually heard this from both from the public company and our not-for-profit perspective, is they would like to see us broad in the nature of this guidance. So when you think of corporate social responsibility and from a not-for-profit, some of the social views that people have, and including getting to a social impact, they would very much like to see us go further. If you're going to actually measure performance, shouldn't it be about what you've set a target for and how you deliver it, and then how you value that difference? So it's interesting the board is going to be, types of feedback the board is getting. And you, no doubt you're aware of various different models. I know some of you have done more work in this area, but there's an opportunity, and that, like I said, will be the board will need to consider when they get the feedback. To go for a little bit more in depth on slide 18 from a securities law perspective and regulations, we do have this guidance does have some intersections. From a Canadian reporting perspective, what we have today is a staff notice, which is not a rule, so it it's not enforceable from their perspective, but it is strong guidance that's applied. Right now, our regulators are going through and plan in September to actually issue a rule to make, in essence, provide more ability to do enforcement. But this staff guidance and work they've been doing over many years is to improve the types of disclosures that are made about those measures. What's interesting in our Canadian marketplace is when you have foreign private issuers, and over 60% of them are also subject to SEC requirements where there is a rule and they do have follow-up questions in relation to those disclosures, some of this is what's enough? What is next appropriate next steps? So this is why we're hoping that within the work that we're doing, we can help them to build out the guidance. And, you know, one of the, I guess, potential ideal solutions from my personal perspective was if they were to pick up some of this guidance to make the, you know, security requirements more robust. That is a potential solution. So with that, I wanted just to touch on very briefly some of our next steps when it comes to the continued work we're going to be doing to promote awareness of this, the extensive consultations as we work to get different views on these proposals from our not-for-profits, our academics, our private enterprises, as well as different task force our CPA Canada has, which are industry-specific. What we are planning to do in order to get very broad outreach is issue a survey in the next week or so to get input, and it's tailored for each of the different stakeholder groups that we think should be involved in this discussion. And we've included as well a geographic representation such that if you were interested in sharing that survey more broadly within your jurisdiction, we'd be very happy to share any of the feedback we get from your region in that. From an accountability perspective, the board has committed to revising and issuing the framework within December. And then if there's based on the need, continuing a process to, should we say, revise it as needed. On slide 20, one just to highlight is some of the feedback we've had is a desire for examples. For example, what kind of policy might I establish or procedures would I do for different types of entities? Of course, to as well the third bullet there on industry guidance and different suggestions as to which ones to do. Those are things our board is considering. So with that, I'd like to turn it to ask some of the questions and wanting to get your feedback. One, as overall, given the approach we've taken, we want to build off the feedback we get to enhance the framework. Looking forward to the suggestions you have for us, as well as for the national standard setters in the room. Do you think that, are you aware of a similar framework existing within your jurisdiction, or would something like this also be helpful within your jurisdiction for different types of companies? And of course, what is that interaction from a securities regulator's perspective?
Sue.
I'm going to ask a selfish question, so focusing on the interaction with us, and I just wondered if I could clarify something. So if I look at slide 15, which looks at the scope of the project, and focus on stuff that measures that are outside the financial statements. So I'm sort of peeking ahead a little bit to the work we're doing on primary financial statements. So so one of the things that we're proposing, as you know, is that we try and require some of these measures that are used for communication to be put in the notes to the financial statements. So something like, I guess, adjusted earnings would be something that might be in the new notes with the proposals that we've been working on. So if that did come into the notes to the financial statements through that project, would it then become an effective gap financial measure, so outside the scope of what you're looking at? So I'm just wondering how that interaction would
work. Possibly. I mean, you know, our view of the world on this is that the reason we chose this direction and we're trying to give people a framework to work with is that regardless, that's my personal view, regardless whether it's in the financial statements or outside the financial statements, wherever it is, the processes that we talk about could be built in, baked in. So, yes, if you actually make a gap, then it would be subject to audit, et cetera. So, technically, we're not trying to get into that domain. However, we think the material in the framework is quality material that people could build in regardless of whether it's in the financial statements or not.
Yes,
so there is a bit of a threshold there that we're trying to work on. And so, I mean, to the extent that you find any of this material helpful, there you go. It's useful to you. That's great.
And I'd certainly agree with that. I thought some of the ideas on governance and the controls and things and what to think about would be relevant no matter where
Absolutely.
It was. But I was just trying to think about how, peeking ahead, the fact that we're sort of trying to encourage more to come into the financial statements and you're focusing on the quality of stuff outside the financial statements, just trying to think a little bit about how
we think there's a point of intersection there. So as we move forward, that's one of the things we're going to be interested to hear from people, because we could certainly change our view on that. And as we work with the securities regulators, years we could change our view on that. From my personal experience, a lot of the material in here is from my past life in terms of what we used to do. And I can readily tell you that you didn't just automatically change from what was in the financial statements to what was out the financial statements. You had the quality around all of it.
Alexandra?
One comment, one question, one suggestion. The first comment is well done. It's really necessary to have, especially having a framework for that. I believe the temptation to go for sector by sector or industry by industry is enormous, but I believe a general framework is very important. The question is management forecast included here? If not, in my view, it should.
So the way I typically answer the question is, are you giving that information to,
yes.
to your analysts?
Yes.
And so I'll give you an example that isn't a management forecast. Well, we met with our not-for-profit advisory council last week. That was why I had to go back from Berlin. And somebody held up a thing from a not-for-profit website that had the financial statement number issue, and next to it, it had the number of endangered frogs. And they made the comment that is this covered by your framework? I said, you put this in the domain of, you've got the financial statement numbers, which, by the way, are audited in our jurisdiction. Not-for-profits have to have audited financial statements. And right next to it, you put the number of endangered frogs as one of your programs. You've given the user the impression that that information has equal quality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's covered by the framework.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because
so I would say yes.
Management forecasts a lot of
yes.
non-GAAP numbers, yeah. non-financial numbers also. So
yeah.
I would say that more clearly because that's quite important.
Okay.
The third one I suggest is when you talk about I believe consistency here for me is the most important thing, because well, people can develop different metrics. It's they can see what the world in different ways. So a faithful representation can have different interpretation. But important, my view is to be consistent on Mario. And I see consistent here actually three ways, not two ways.
Okay.
Consistent over time. That's what you mentioned. And consistent across companies. So let me do something consistently over time. Let me do that consistently with other companies. I take, for example, a non-recurring or a recurring earning per share number, for example. What if I'm excluding, for example, litigation cost here, it's good that I exclude that over time, so it's always excluded. And it's interesting to compare with other companies that are also excluded. But for me, there is a third dimension, which is consistent with other elements. So if I'm other elements of the financial performance, in this case, financial performance is the, if I'm excluding legal cost because it's non-recurrent,
right.
Am I excluding the top revenues that are non-recurrent too?
Okay.
Or am I cherry-picking and only excluding? Because I don't have any statistics on that. My view is that companies exclude most of the time, expenses.
Mm.
It's very hard to say, oh, this is not a recurring top line. Everything that's in the top line is should be there. But a lot of, you see, that there's EBITDA and all those other, it excludes a lot of expenses or losses, or etc. But it's very hard to see people excluding on the top line. So my view is, it's consistent. If you're applying this concept to the expense side of the discussion, you apply the same concept to the revenue side of the discussion. And I see that's different. I don't know if the word consistency is the right word here, but that came to my mind.
So that's a very helpful thought. I think that in the article Anthony wrote that he cited that it was 90%+ of all the adjustments were favorable, right?
Yes.
So it's, of course,
yes.
what you're saying. I just want to go back to across companies, because we've used the term comparability, and we have said that it's much more difficult to get comparability. So that's why we kind of link that to transparency that says,
allow people to do it.
You should give them enough information, tell them how it's been computed, so that hopefully they can then achieve some comfort for the users.
That's my point with the third element, which is what am I excluding or not?
Yeah.
If you don't tell me that you have a non-recurring revenue,
right.
I don't know. There's
right.
no way for me to know that.
Okay.
So I would take the top line as recurrent and all those expenses are non-recurrent. But when I forecast that, so I assume that. And that's another way, no other way to separate them.
Okay.
Tak.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to congratulate such a nice presentation, and I think this is very important motivation. If I could make some suggestion, let me try. Actually, this is not really a new issue, because the information other than financial statement was always has been always important, such as new technology or a personality of CEO. It has been around. But recently, as you said, some people says they use financial information only for 10% of their judgment, or the maximum 10%. And we shouldn't overlook two elements. One element is the recent economic environment. Thanks to the quantitative easing or financial environment, people are getting more aggressive. So therefore, there are lots of money coming into the equity market. So therefore, investors are looking for the good side of the company. And the second point is data availability. So in the past, there was no website, but now we have website and SNS, and lots of internal information is available to public. So therefore, people can easily access to the internal information. So those internal information could be much more attractive than the boring financial information. So therefore, these informations were very important, especially when investors are seeking for upside. So if investors want to pick up some company who may grow right. in the future, so they want to find out something good point, new technology or new market or whatever. So that point we should not really forget. But we have to look at downside as well. So when it is going up, everything is fine. But when it comes to the downside, then, as you said, what information is more reliable? Right. What kind of assurance do we have? So I think the financial information could be the base for the downside when the economy goes downside. And based on that financial information, the quality of the information you have got when it was upside. So that should be checked. So therefore, if we could provide such kind of mechanism, well, that would be very useful and constrain some of the fake information, too much rosy information.
That's very helpful. Yeah. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
But I do hope that we are not there just for the downside of things.
Sorry?
I do hope that we are not just there for the downside.
Yeah, I know.
Gary?
Thank you. It also second my friend Tuck. I thought this was an outstanding document, and I read the consultation paper as well, and equally as well, and compliments to the staff on how fast it was turned around. Just a few reactions, Linda, to some of the things you said, and also respond to something Alexandro said. I think I'm looking at slide 15, but I mean, all the stuff in here is great if you get it from all the columns across. And I think on comparability versus consistency, I think if you're going to go for comparability, I think you're looking at a much longer project than you are. I think consistency within an entity is more important than trying to get comparability between entities, given, it's one thing when you're in gap measures, but as you progressively get further away from gap, it's harder to do. So I think within a company, being consistent in disclosure methodology is more useful. So you can think, are things getting bigger, better, smaller, worse, or whatever? You can see the trends, and sometimes the trend is much more important than the absolutes. If you were looking for some sort of comparability, say within an industry, and there's often widely accepted industry measures that they commonly use, and you've got barrels of oil equivalent per day, I mean, the energy industry has got all sorts of very common measures. What you could consider in your framework is if the industry has a common, widely accepted measure, do you or do you not use it? And if you don't use it, why not? That's the thought. I think and I agree with the comments that, most of the one-offs flagged out are expenses. You don't talk about the non-recurring gains and revenues. discussion long, many years ago on that before I joined the board in a working group, and I think the sense there was, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, I'm just sharing it, was you're in the business to generate revenues, and you're putting all and organization efforts, they're big, they're small, they come in chunks, they come in straight line, but that's your business. You're not in the business to generate non-recurring debits. I mean, there's sort of things to be avoided. In that sense, there is a, at least the working group I was in had a gestalt, they're different. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying I agree with that or buy into it. I'm just sharing that for what you would consider it for.
I don't buy it.
Yeah, I strongly
disagree. No, yeah, I didn't say I did, you know, but I'm just saying there's another view that, you know, you're in the business to create revenues.
You're in the business of making money, but nevertheless, sometimes you make a lot.
Litigation costs are as part of your life as selling property, not part of your life.
Well, the problem you've got in litigation, particularly that standard ordinary business, you've always got small charges. Every now and then you get a big one. So it's a frequency or size is the thing. It cannot be frequency because they are always there in small amounts. It's got to be size.
If take all the banks in the world in the last 10 years, they all exclude litigation costs from their recurring income. And everybody had litigation costs, so it was really part of life.
And huge ones. Ilhan? Sorry, Rebecca, you wanted to come in?
If I could, just to respond to Gary, to your comment, because part of what, in essence, some of our users are very much encouraging is to actually see a change in practice. They do want us to go to an industry basis. And while many, several industries have developed their own measures, what they are seeing over time, actually, is that companies tend to shift, and they're not using that core measure anymore. So some industries are going back and saying they need to revise. So in essence, that's why they're wanting to see kind of another party get involved to try to bring more of that comparability across. But what we tried to do within the framework is not, because there's a balance between what we heard from some preparers is, I don't know what my peer is doing to calculate that measure, and they could be doing it the same or differently. Mm-hmm. So what we've tried to encourage as part of this discussion is actually to say, okay, well, if you think you are using a common measure, acknowledge that, and if you're going to be different from it, disclose that as well. So, or enough information that the user can then do that comparison. So I do think we can work to get consistency and encourage that within an entity, but to get comparability, it's going to take kind of several steps.
Well, you can't do it because you're right. Companies don't necessarily show everything's proprietary. They don't necessarily show it in a useful way, you know, the level of detail needed. Consistency is more important. But like takes an airline industry, on-time arrival measures, that's a widely used statistic. And that actually is a verifiable if you follow the FAA guidelines of how you measure it. But you might not agree with that if you're one of the airlines and have your own measure, you know.
But if there was disclosure about it so that the reader could see both, that will then help them in their understanding. So
disclose it and either use it or I don't, and explain why you don't if you don't.
Kimberly? Oh, yes, I'm listening. Thank you.
Thank you. We have received comments from five member jurisdictions. And most AOSS members think that the content and structure of the framework is useful. But however, members think the draft framework is similar to the concept of framework in applying the qualitative characteristics and to the IFRS practice statement management commentary. And also, there was a concern about the compatibility across entities because the draft framework is non-mandatory. And regarding question 2 and 3, so most member jurisdictions have their own laws and regulations for disclosing non-GAAP information. And the laws and regulations provide the principle, guidance, and best practice for disclosing non-GAAP information, which are similar to the draft framework. And all members think the draft framework is unlikely to be widely applied on a voluntary basis. One member is concerned the draft framework is duplication of the local rules and regulations and suggested conducting further research to confirm the compatibility of the draft framework with local legislation. And many members noted that improving the overall reporting information requires behavioral changes, which then requires a paradigm shift in the mindset of all parties. So therefore, significant education and coordination effort is necessary.
Kimmy.
Just also want to start by echoing the comments around the room about congratulations on doing a great piece of work. This is really an important topic globally. So, well done, particularly in the timeframes. In terms of your first question about the framework itself, I particularly liked the way that you used the QCs from the conceptual framework. You grounded it in the conceptual framework, but also gave examples to bring it to life. And as we know, preparers don't really spend their days reading the conceptual framework, so it won't be familiar to them. So I can understand why you've tried to make the language more user-friendly. And I think the more you can do around examples to kind of bring it to life for them, the better. I think in terms of some couple of specific comments, the structure, I did get a little bit confused when you got into the pillars about why some of the QCs were in Pillar 3 rather than Pillar 1. I thought that all of the QCs were helpful in terms of Pillar 1, which was around selecting your performance measures. And probably another specific comment around materiality could probably have a little bit more fleshing out as to how you apply materiality outside of the financial statements. So that's something to look at. Similar to other comments, we could see that there clearly was a link with the management commentary work. And one way of, you could look at this is you could have a broader framework that applies to all types of information that's outside of the financial statements but is still aimed at the users of financial statements, so the investors and lenders and other users of financial statements, which would all have the similar principles in terms of the QCs, and then this could be a specific application of that broader framework. So that's one way of going about it. In terms of usefulness in a jurisdiction, we've actually looked at questions 2 and 3 together because they're kind of overlapping. Would it be useful? It actually depends on what have you already got in your jurisdiction. So if I start with the for-profit sector, I think, and this is a personal view, that it could be very useful in I think, probably both in New Zealand and Australia. Hopefully Chris is not going to jump on me for saying that. She's nodding, so I'm good. We do have, obviously, local guidance from our regulators in New Zealand and Australia around the presentation of these types of measures. But that guidance very much focuses on the communication disclosure aspects. So really the section you've got on communicating effectively in Appendix C is where the regulator guidance sits, whereas I think your framework is more comprehensive because you're taking it back a step and looking at step one, really, how did the entity go about selecting those performance measures in the first place? And I think that's where your guidance can really help preparers in thinking about that and can be structured in a way that actually sits alongside that regulatory guidance. It doesn't compete with it, it actually complements and builds on it. So I think that can be done. Obviously, it's important to work with them, as you've said, to make sure the regulators are on board, but I think it certainly can be done. In the not-for-profit sector, where obviously you're looking at both for-profit and not-for-profit, I guess we're in a bit of a different space. In New Zealand, we've recently done an accounting standard on service performance reporting, which covers much of the same ground, and I certainly recognised, reading your framework, a lot of the things that sit in our service performance standard, which is going to be a mandatory requirement for our large and medium-sized registered charities and also subject to audit. So they will already be doing that, but however, I'm going to plan on asking the staff to have a look at what you've done to see if there's ideas we can pick up for the guidance that we're developing to go along with our standard. So we might plagiarise some of it for that. And I should also say that Australia is also working on a standard on service performance reporting as well. And probably lastly, just for completeness, we did get some feedback from preparers in Australia who are probably a little bit less enthusiastic, and they were emphasising the need to be flexible, principles-based, so that it's adaptable for different sectors and changing performance measures over time. I think that's consistent with some of the feedback you said that you've received as well, and I think it's that initial reaction That we're, there's nothing mandatory at the moment, that they sort of react and say, oh, don't stop me from being able to tell my story. But I personally didn't see anything rules-based or prescriptive at all in your framework. It was very much, I think, principles-based. So I think it may be an initial reaction once people sort of get on board. That would work.
Mary?
Thank you. I had a question from a somewhat different perspective. As I sat here and looked at the paper, especially, for example, the discussion in paragraph 19, it seemed to be, you know, very helpfully about the process that you undertake and the, you know, the considerations, process, and controls. And that just set off a little, not alarm bell, but, you know, made me think for a minute about how unusual it would be for us to start writing, you know, an accounting standard about how you are to do essentially books and records and reporting, as opposed to what your objectives are or you know, limits on it. And I don't know the extent. I mean, I think it's great that you've been able to pull together so many different parties to give you input. And certainly, we hear from time to time from the auditing standard setters, the IAASB, that they wish we'd write more about minimum documentation requirements and, you know, minimum process controls, and we tend not to. But is that kind of a stress point that maybe reflects the either the collaboration or an environment where you do more reporting on controls? It isn't that we couldn't do it, and some of these things we could just ask people to describe in, let's say, an accounting policy disclosure, mm-hmm. but not all of them. I mean, I think the document is richer and more helpful for covering the broader range, but I think that that's maybe one of the, it might be a stress point in terms of transposing it, you know, some of this guidance into other settings, is if it goes beyond kind of the classic financial reporting.
So we weren't trying to make this a standard, mm-hmm. and so we felt we had some poetic license. A lot of what you see in that one paragraph, as I said, reflects what some of the higher quality reporters are actually doing.
Yeah.
So in our dialogue with them, they build controls. They're used to the control mindset. They have to do the internal control certification. So they build some of that same thinking into some of their other processes. And in particular, one particular very senior director talked to me about why wouldn't management do this, and you guys should be telling them that they already do it over here, so they should be doing it over here. So it was the sum total of a few different conversations that led us to say, well, we're not writing this as a standard. We're saying this is helpful. It's a framework. We could put this in and see what people have to say about it.
And it isn't a criticism of it.
No,
I think
no,
it makes it a lot richer. I think it just it's when you're trying to bring all together all the things that you do to make this reporting better, as opposed to, you know, the narrower perspective, because I thought it was a better written document for that broader perspective. The other thing I did, you know, as I was reading it, it wasn't quite clear to me what you might be doing if you went on to do industry-specific guidance. You know, I guess there could be collecting of information about what the typical measures are, but it sounds like it becomes pretty quickly calculation guidance, because I'm inferring from the user comments that they want standardization of the calculation of key industry measures, and that gets pretty hard to deliver.
Yeah, so if the users had their way, most of the more vocal users would like this to be stronger, industry-specific, and mandatory. We're not necessarily going there. But the point is one of the things that we do well is engage people in kind of committee work and things like that. So to the extent that we work with CPA Canada or the CFA, and we provide a forum where we bring people together and they want to drive it down to that level, that's probably the next step we're going to talk about, as opposed to necessarily an independent standard setter. I can't see right now, speaking as one board member, I can't see us now suddenly coming out with guidance in the next year or two that says, here's what mining does, here's what telecommunications does, here's what software does. I don't think that's necessarily the role that we want to play, but by just doing this, we seem to have gotten people's attention on that topic, so others may want to move that forward. We already, in Canada, we have actually, in real estate, we already have an association that has done measures for real estate, and the VP of Finance from that industry association is a board member on the ECSB. We've also done the same thing for, I think it's Gold, isn't it?
Gold.
So we have a couple of industry examples where people are have worked through it themselves and are doing a good job. So we could sponsor bringing people together, but we, the board has to decide next steps and where we put our resources.
Anne?
Echo other people's comments. Great work here. A couple of comments that relate to the slide 17, the picture that you've got. So when I look at all those elements, I assume that you've documented a lot of things that people have told you. So these are things that exist in practice or people, things that people are already doing. And I wonder to what extent you document what people are doing and then you also think about their aspirational side. Because as we hear you talk about it, there's a lot in this framework that's aspirational in the sense that you're wanting to change people's behaviour. So when I go back and look at the elements, I think, well, some of the people are already doing this, some aren't. There's a lot going on. It's very busy. I wonder the extent to which, as you formulate how you're going to present this as a working document for people to use, that you can stand back and work out what are the aspirational things that people should be putting, going towards, whether you can bring that out. There's a sense of it in the pillars, in the four pillars in the document, but I'm just wondering the extent to which you can think, well, there's this basic stuff that people do, but if they did this better by aiming at this, that would lift everyone's game.
Well, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. And my other comment was about also about the busyness of that slide in 17. And I wondered if you might also analyse what you've got here, all these important and interesting things, in a different way, which would be supplementary to what's in 17, where you think about what are inputs, what are process, and what are outputs. Because it's all there. All these things are going on. And what you want is to present your material in a way that people can look at your diagram and go, yes, I can see what I'm supposed to do with this. Whereas at the moment, all of those things are valid. I'm not saying take anything away. But if you present another diagram that says, well, these are things coming in, this is the processing part and who's responsible here, and then this is what we expect, aspirationally, this is what we expect out the other end, might be something to think about. Thank you.
Cédric.
Well, we have briefly discussed your paper, which was very appreciated. People are very supportive of a principles-based approach in that area regarding MPM or RPM in that case. Many of them consider also that a lot of non-financial information is already required by law in France in many areas, and that they are still already complying with the governance and due process issues, since it is already mandatory in a couple of in the preparation of the regulatory report, the issue. Maybe the issues that have been raised is regarding the level of detail of such a guidance. If it remains principle-based, people are okay. If it becomes too prescriptive, there is a risk, even if it remains non-authoritative, not mandatory, that people have to declare that they comply with such a framework. If it's further detailed, then there is a risk that some of them see that it will lead to a kind of report on internal control. I wouldn't compare with the American system, but some of them would fear that we come to a kind of SOX report in the future. And I mean, the paragraph 50 is describing the principle of internal control, but it may be supplemented by additional guidance in such a case. There will be an issue because on the one hand, people consider that it's not the same scope to define what should be in the report and how to organize it from an internal control point of view. And second issue is whether it would lead to an audit or a certification of internal controls.
Nick?
Thank you. So congratulations on stimulating the debate. You've already done it this afternoon, I'm sure, beforehand. I mean, for me, combining financial information and non-financial information has always been central to the investment decision-making process. So I think anything that information is very much welcome, and the transparency around that information also. But I wonder what the real goal and the real aspiration for users is here. I think you've hinted at it already, Linda, that what they really want is something prescriptive, often on a sector-wide basis, something that is truly comparable. And the number or the metric that always sticks in my mind is like-for-like sales in the retail environment, because there are so many different ways of defining that,
right.
And companies use that to their advantage when it suits them. And is it their aspiration that they would actually like that to be prescriptive and comparable, but not only for Canadian companies, but to compare Canadian companies with US companies and Japanese companies and so forth? Is that, this is, for them, this is a stepping stone, which is welcome, but is that really where they want to get to?
And will we get there?
We have the same struggles in PFS, comparability against entity-specific problems. They're very similar challenges.
Yeah. Christine?
So just building on something that Talk was saying about the use of information outside of the financial statements, and when we talk about the financial information, the information in the financial statements accounting for 10%, I'm never quite sure how to interpret that. Because it may be that, you know, if we first of all think about there's economy-wide information, then there's industry-specific or sector-specific information, and then there's entity-specific information. So first of all, I'm not sure if they're just saying 10% of their entity-specific information or 10% of the whole population. If it's the whole population, then my first question would be, well, how much of that is actually entity-specific? Is it only 30% of their information set? Now they're saying it's, you know, 10%, one-third of that is coming from financial reports. So I'm just not sure how to interpret that. So let's just assume for a moment that they are saying it's 10% of the whole. Well, I don't know if that's good or bad. I don't know what my expectation would be to begin with, whether that's too much or too little. But if I just take it at face value, then I think we can say the other 90% is a big bucket, and that it's really good that you have gone through this effort of saying, let's try to get a conversation going about best practices around that information that is outside of the financial statements, because we know that it is a big bucket that users are relying upon, and they are maybe either unaware of or don't feel that they can move the needle on the quality of that information that they're getting if it's not adequate. So I think the focus is great. As a result of that, I think that the what Anne was talking about, what's the thing that we really want them to focus on? I think the most important piece of this for me was transparency. And the reason for that is because, you know, sunlight is a very good disinfectant. If there are companies that are willing to start on a voluntary basis being much more transparent about how they're calculating some of these metrics, that will help users to understand where the numbers are coming from. It will also provide them with an opportunity to start pressuring other entities within the industry that may not be as transparent. So I really think of all of the things that are emphasized throughout this document, transparency and how to get more transparency or encourage more transparency is really where the biggest bang for the buck might come from. And then the last comment that I have is, and it's just a question, I don't expect a response to this one at all, but, you know, once this is out, once it's out there, what is your measure of success, and how are you going to assess that? Is it based on downloads, you know, how many times the document is downloaded? Is it based on a survey that you might do, asking companies if they're aware of the document and how
you know, have they implemented it or not? Is it looking to actual information that companies are presenting and seeing some mention of this as sort of why they're changing what they're, you know, I don't know what it might be, but I would just encourage you to think about that, particularly before you might go down the path of doing industry specific, because you want to demonstrate, I think, some actual evidence that, that it made a difference. And then use that as motivation to continue.
Okay. Any other comments, questions?
Yeah, I just have a comment on your 10%. I believe that depends a lot on who you ask that question. We take sometimes buy-side investors say they don't use much financial statements. They say, well, where you got your earnings from? See, well, I got from the earnings consensus of the sell side.
Right.
The earnings consensus of the sell side. So they say, no, the earnings consensus is not a financial statement information. Well, but it's derived from financial. So it is...
Yeah, it's even slippy how you define... Or I got it from the data aggregator. Well, where did the data aggregator get that from? So it is a hard thing to assess. But I don't think it's necessary to motivate what you're doing, I think.
Okay. Thank you, Linda, Rebecca, for the discussion.